morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning to our program on social action in Syracuse. A few reminders. I mentioned before that at Thursday Morning Roundtable next month, we will be presenting the 43rd annual TMR Award for Meritorious Service to the Community. Nominations are due April 2nd. That's, I think, 2 weeks from today. So if you have someone in mind, send us some information. You can find the form on the website. Also, the Onondaga Citizens League is seeking nominations for the 14th annual Levi L. Smith Civic Education Award. Those nominations are due March 30th. The award will be presented at the OCL annual meeting. And again, more information on the website, OnondagaCitizensLeague.org. Next week at TMR, we'll be continuing our kind of recreation of TMR topics from March of 1965. Our topic next week will be the dilemma of public welfare. Our speaker will be Ann Rooney, Deputy County Executive for Community Services. So we could go lots to talk about there. It'd be an interesting topic. So again, 50th anniversary this year. Today our topic is the same as that of the March 18th, 1965 roundtable, The Meaning of Social Action in Syracuse. The speaker back then was Warren Hagstrom. Dr. Hagstrom was an SU professor, and he was director of a program. It was part of the new War on Poverty. It was called the Community Action Training Center. It was a little bit controversial. And also, needless to say, somewhat short-lived. Although we don't have any records of what was said at the roundtable back then, there, I did find some newspaper clippings about that time. And it was a program that was initiated not only in Syracuse, but in other cities around the country. Dr. Hagstrom was the academic coordinator. They were training students and community people how to organize. How to empower themselves, poor people, that is, and how to work themselves out of poverty. One of the newspaper editorials around that time put it this way, though, Syracuse is not the only city in which federal funds are being spent to finance a potential class struggle between the haves and the have-nots. The mayor at the time, you remember, Bill Walsh, who was our first speaker, considered this agitation in how to fight City Hall. So the program obviously wasn't very popular with those in power, and pretty soon it lost favor with the university, and it went by the wayside, although there was another program that kind of took its place and then eventually evolved into what we know as Peace Incorporated today. But that brings us to today's speakers. All social activists in Syracuse. Walt Dixie is president of the National Action Network, the Syracuse chapter, and executive director of Jubilee Homes. Welcome, Walt. Welcome back. Andy Major has been a community organizer and activist for 35 years. He's currently at Syracuse Cultural Workers, but we remember him also from the campaign coordinator for the two-row wampum renewal campaign. He spoke about that here. And also spent several years at the Syracuse Peace Council. Ursula Razum has been involved locally with the movement for migrants and workers' rights. She's been active in the Green Party, as we know. She's been involved in campaigns, Get Out the Vote, and also as a candidate for the 24th District of the U.S. House of Representatives. Ursula is currently an organizer for the Syracuse Peace Council. Thanks for being here, Ursula. Peter Sarver, TMR member, is executive director at Welsh Terrace Supportive Housing. He's a volunteer leader with ACTS, the Alliance for Communities Transforming Syracuse. He's also the ACTS convener for Moving People Transportation Coalition. And full disclosure, he's a board member of the Onondaga Citizens League. He's also former president and CEO of Hospice. Now, being the community organizers that they are, this group took it upon themselves a couple of weeks ago to get together and decide how they were going to present. So take it away.
Thank you. I'm going to start out, and before I talk about what I planned to. Hearing what Sandra spoke of reminded me that among the 50th anniversaries that we're looking at, the 50th anniversary of this program took place at a very important time in our nation's history. Bloody Sunday in Selma had happened already a week and a half or so before the 18th of March, but the federal support for what became the final march from from Selma to Montgomery that entered Montgomery somewhere between 25,000 and 30,000 strong and eventually led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act had yet to come. So that I'm sure that there was lots of awareness and discussion and concern about that. And as some of you know, there were community leaders, faith leaders who went from Syracuse down to Selma for that second part of the events down there. So I want to honor that history. As I think about social action here in our community, I want to start by thinking about where it is we are. What is this land on which we exist and work now? And it's the homeland of the Onondaga Nation, people who have been here for thousands of years. And we're also very close to the site where perhaps the first true democratic government in history was set up over 1,000 years ago on the shores of Onondaga Lake, when the Onondaga leaders came together with their brethren in the Cayuga, Seneca, Oneida, and Mohawk nations to form the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And although there's little real teaching about this, in fact, that document and those teachings were an important inspiration for the founding of the United States and what we now talk about as Western democracy. Most of us learned that it came from Greece and came over from Europe, a place that was ruled at that point by kings and despots, et cetera. So, in fact, in 1744, Canisatego, one of the leaders of the Onondaga Nation, was part of a treaty conference in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where he specifically encouraged colonial leaders to follow their example and form a confederacy to join together in a union if they wanted freedom and independence. And ironically, the person who printed the notes from that meeting into a booklet was, at that point, a not very well-known printer in Philadelphia named Benjamin Franklin, who went on to play a key role in the founding of the United States and many other important advancements. So that's the basis on which I think about starting. But then as you move forward, this area has been the home to very, very important social movements for hundreds of years. The abolitionist movement was very fertile here. And the Jerry Rescue, which was a really critical sign of resistance to the efforts to maintain slavery, is one of the proudest moments, I believe, in our civic history here. The women's rights movement here was very critical. The Seneca Falls was where the first convention was held, and Matilda Jocelyn Gage from just down the road in Fayetteville played a key role in all of that, although she's been written out of much of the mainstream history. Since that time, there's been important work for labor rights, to protect the environment, for civil rights. So we stand on a great legacy of people working for change. And when I think about the kind of change we're talking about and this meaning of social action, to me it's about grassroots people, citizens like ourselves, getting involved, working together collectively to make the community a better place, finding ways that we can organize, as Sandra talked about in terms of that short-lived program. And I wonder a little bit how things would be here if that program hadn't been short-lived, but instead there had been ongoing community organizer training here, because as someone who's done that work for many years, I often think that there's few people who really understand what it means and have developed the skills to do that. We're taught a great deal about how to fend for ourselves, about how to be individuals, but not so much about how to work collectively and how to think about the broader concerns. And in many ways, in my mind, much of this is about what of the sort of founding concerns that we talk about as a people, our aspirations as a nation, where do we focus? And for the most part, I believe we focus on the individual achievement, on the pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps, rather than the justice, the equality, the solidarity that, in my mind, are the much greater aspirations that we claim as a nation and which ought to be guiding us as we move forward. So when I think about today and the key issues we face, that what people referred to there as class warfare, the issue of inequality, which is a critical issue. We are in the midst, certainly, of some degree of economic recovery, but many, many people are being left behind. The wages of most working people are far, far below what they were 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, and that's a major problem for working people, for poor people. And connected with that is tremendous growth in the power of corporations, this idea that corporations are people, that they deserve free speech rights, that they can play a major role in our electoral system, has really distorted democracy, and it's something we really need to confront if we want to retain a meaningful democracy in this country. A key overarching issue for all of this, in my mind, that we face at this point is what's happening with the climate. That although there's still some people who want to deny that our activities are creating the kind of climate change and warming around the globe, which is leading to all kinds of horrific climate events, it's very clear to almost the entire population that, in fact, we are causing that, and we need to step up quickly to make changes in how we live, in our government policies, so that we can avert the worst of climate chaos. It's very clear at this point that climate change is upon us. We cannot avoid it, but we can lessen its impact. We can move to a green economy in ways that will generate jobs and create a better and healthier community for all of us in that process. And I guess I want to close by, some of you might know I have a son, Eli, who just turned 12, and we were talking in the car recently, and the issue of climate change came up again, and he said, you know, I don't want to hear it. You know, I get it, but I don't want to hear it. And it reminded me that this is our problem, that the adults, the people who run our communities, have created these issues, and it's our responsibility to solve them and to try and make it better for these young people who are coming up, rather than seeing them as the problem or believing that they're the ones that need to solve the problems that we've created. So I invite you to join those of us up here and the millions of people around our country and around the world who are working to protect the climate and in the process to defend the rights and dignity of people all over the world. So I'm going to pass it on to Walt. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, to be with this group here is awesome, so I hope you don't feel threatened by us because we're agitators, but it's okay. That's what we do professionally, we agitate. But on a sad note, you know, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Selma, Alabama, and I've been down there last year, and if you go down there, it is the mecca of social justice in our country, and it's two worlds. It is very poor for black and even poor whites. There's no opportunity of jobs. The status quo, the criminal justice system, I don't need to talk to you about it, it's pervasive across this country. So in one place of Selma, you would think it'd be the shining light of what the movement of Martin King and others have pushed for, that we have not moved the bar as what we should do. So it reminds me every day when we talk about social action in Syracuse, of mobilization, is to really challenge us, how do we come together, not just to feel good, but to make change, but also Trevor Martin, the mother, said at a meeting, is that the challenge for the movement is that we need to go to those who are not in our silos and educate. So when we have tension, it shouldn't be confrontation. It should be how we rectify problems. So one of the things I want to just reflect on, and I see some individuals here that was a part of, how do we get things done, really done? When Reverend Howard and I see Reverend Avery, Linda Irvin, and Father O'Brien, Frank Williver, Hal Garman, they were all on our board. And there was a time when Reverend Howard, you know, challenged the downtown churches to say, what can we do to collaborate in terms of black and white clergy beginning to come together in the late 80s. And there was never the relationship. And he pushed that conversation. And that's when the birth of Time of Jubilee came into existence, and through Tom Young, to focus on an area that was so needed and is still needed today. It's housing. So when you look at all the great work that's been done in housing in Syracuse, it started with a little small organization of Time of Jubilee with the Bob McAuliffe as our attorney. Ann Peterson was on the Dollar Savings Bank to do land trusts and to build a community that, because of our action, because of the individuals taking on this challenge, is to address housing initiatives. That's the birth of I come from, of seeing these injustices. And we still see today there's still a lot of injustice in housing, affordable rent to apartments. So we still got a long ways to go. And so, you know, as we think about, when I think about Reverend Charlton and why I believe in Reverend Charlton, there's those who, you know, try to down him, but in our community, he is a symbol of recognizing the disparities on a host of issues in our community. And how do we begin to address that? And one of the areas that we have dealt with in terms of the movement is, and Andy said something that was very important because this was not by design, is that we all worked in our own individual little circles of activism. And then there was a group called United One that was formalized. So we talk a little bit of this organization, that would be the New York Civil Liberty, the Green Party, the NAACP, and others. We came together, started networking together to deal with policy issues. And I think, you know, for me, the social action is that if we don't change policies, you know, we can throw the cocktail bottles, we can say no justice, no peace, but it doesn't build the community, as I, my opening, talking about Selma, Alabama. And so I think it's strength in numbers, and I think that Linda Irvin is here. I want to give her a big shout out because one issue that we was concerned about is jail oversight. We've had numerous killings in the Justice Center, numerous beatings. Folks are being mistreated like animals. A parent would come in and want to see a loved one, and they're treated like a hostile enemy, is to add the culture of the public safety building. And so one of the great things happened is the dialogue with Linda and Monica to start off with in New York Civil Liberty to then convince over time, this didn't happen right away, but then to begin to create what's called a jail oversight is moving forward so that there is transparency moving forward. To me, that's a great accomplishment. And then on top of that, the bonus was through all our great work that we all do together and for the county ledge and the leadership on there is to bring back the Human Rights Office. And so for all of us that do what we do, right, and for all of you that sit in this room that deals with these issues, is that it is probably a shame that we all should say that in the city of Syracuse for how many years we didn't have a human rights office. Did we even bother to push that? And so what I learned from Bob McAuliffe, that when folks said you couldn't sell land trust homes in the city of Syracuse, Bob McAuliffe, late Bob McAuliffe, was the one that went and educated his peers about the value of doing this. So the message I want to do as an activist is that you don't have to necessarily be at a meeting, but your voice in terms of those that lead this community in many areas is lending your voice to change, to give them a perspective that they don't know. And so that's why we always use the word tension, and we continue to push these envelopes, and because you to this day, and I feel every day, for all I feel I've accomplished in my life, when I measure myself, I always feel I have not done enough, you know? And I think that we as a community become complacent when we move to the suburbs, we get a nice job, our kids in college, we may write a check to a dinner, and we think that's it. No, you have to come back into these communities. And my role as an activist is to always shed the light on injustice. Thank you.
So there's a lot I'd like to say, and you know, when Walt was making his comments about the United as One Coalition and the Jail Oversight Committee, I think it's a really recent reminder of what happens when community members come together and work together. And I'm thinking of a time. There's a lot I'd like to say, so I'll try to keep it to 5 minutes. How we agreed we would. Today, I don't know if everyone's aware, it's the 12th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And back then, people were calling the U.S., the international anti-war movement and protesters really as the second greatest superpower. And I think that was, and I think we've come a long time. We've come a little bit of ways, I think, in terms of the anti-war movement in the opposite direction right now. I think 12 years later, you know, we were not going to see people in the streets, even though Congress is still is considering another authorization for use of military force. We've spent millions in the Middle East. We still have the U.S. military now using drones to kill civilians. It's all a little bit depressing. I think of Joe Rossi here. He made a joke that he might heckle me the way that me and my friend Amelia from the Peace Council, we interrupted the president a couple of years ago. And, you know, that stemmed from the imprisonment of Private Manning, who actually took action to expose U.S. war crimes in Iraq, the shooting of civilians by U.S. military. And that was an action that me and Amelia took that was somewhat, you know, somewhat controversial, but and it wasn't very popular.
But I think it points to a little bit the need to expose injustice in any way possible, in ways that aren't always popular, and that in any venue that you can find. And I think that is really part of social action, is to do things that make people uncomfortable, right, and that stray out of what is considered respectable. One of the challenges that I see today as a young activist is the professionalization of activism and action. And I think it might have been a little bit of a different time 50 years ago. A lot of my peers right now are looking to do work in, you know, the nonprofit sector, thinking that there's always going to be a nonprofit that solves a problem. And I think it strays a little bit away from this idea that we have to have active citizens in their own lives. You know, you're a worker, you're a teacher, you're a supermarket clerk. That takes a little bit of time out of your daily life to take social action. And I think what some of the things that we're mentioning here is the need to have strong organizations that create spaces for citizens, no matter what your day job is, to have opportunities to take action collectively. I grew up in a very politically opinionated family. Growing up, we had a lot of talk around the dinner table about foreign policy, especially, but also domestic policy. And I think it's important to make the distinction between being politically opinionated and being politically active. And so I think I found the Syracuse Peace Council in 2008 when I moved back to Syracuse. And it was kind of exactly what I always had been looking for, but I didn't know what I was looking for. You know, we're not really taught the history, I think, very well of social struggle and social change. And I think that, you know, maybe that is that's like another challenge I think that we face in terms of getting citizens more active. I think you see leaders historically, whether we talk about Martin Luther King Jr., and I think a lot of our history focuses on individuals, but now we learn more, like from like the movie that came out, Selma, that, you know, it's not just one person, that there's really a large community of people working with people that we see as leaders. And so I think this venue is actually very important, and I like the way Andy started off with the history of collective struggle that that we're not really taught. And so I think the goal of the job or the purpose of social action is to really show that there is a community of people, and that you do not have to accept injustices in the status quo as, yes, you know, as they are, and also to provide a vision of a better way. And we don't I don't think it's necessary for social movement and social action to have all the answers, but to show that, you know, the way things are, you know, isn't the way they should be. And I do think that there's still a long way to go. I think of the history that I know of the civil rights movement, and that economic human rights were a major focus of that. And, you know, I think of our underfunded schools, the fact that we still don't have universal health care in this country points to that we have still a lot of work to do in terms of winning our economic human rights. And so I think that, the main thing that I think is important to think of is that social action isn't always popular, but when people come together and work for social change, it can be very empowering. And, you know, I'm working at the Syracuse Peace Council, and we're a multi-issue organization, and some of us, you know, do things that are agitational and unpopular. I'm sure you've had people here that have spoken at Thursday morning roundtable that have gotten a lot of attention for blockading, for example, the base at Hancock Air Base. But what we don't always talk about as much is that we also have members that are working on things like the United as One Coalition to bring oversight to the jails, and the jails members with our committee, Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, that Andy is a part of, are working alongside the Onondaga Nation on things like cleaning up Onondaga Lake, and we work together to ban hydrofracking in New York State. So there's lots of different tactics that fall in the category of social action, and I think the challenge for each of us is to figure out how we can fit social action into our lives and to see ourselves as people that can bring our friends, our families, and communities to engage together in social action, because that's when it's really empowering and effective, is when you find ways to come together. So I guess I'll wrap up with that. And I hope I wasn't too depressing.
No.
I mean, it's a scary world out there, and I think we have to talk about these, you know, these really challenging things. So thank you.
Okay. So 50 years, I just was thinking that everything has changed, and yet nothing has changed. The struggle continues for social justice, and I think folks who are social activists are fundamentally hopeful people, not necessarily optimistic. While Ursula represents a much younger generation than myself, I am hopeful that her generation will pick up the banner that my generation and those that went before me continued to see as an essential, important part of our humanity and our community. So while I'm not necessarily optimistic, because 50 years later we're still struggling, I continue to be hopeful that things will change, things do change, things improve. Let me tell you a little bit about ACTS. It's the Alliance of Communities Transforming Syracuse. We are a grassroots interfaith network advocating for social justice. Our mission is to come together as people of faith and conscience. We're committed to work towards systemic change necessary to rectify our community's social, economic, educational, and political inequities. ACTS member organizations are some 24 congregations from the Jewish, Muslim, Zen, and Christian traditions. These congregations are both urban and suburban. Member organizations are also non-sectarian justice groups such as Parents for Public Schools, the Peace Council, SEIU 1199. We now also have individual members not necessarily associated with one of the organizations. While the core of our activity is congregation-based community organizing, we work in numerous settings with a variety of allies. ACTS was originally organized through the efforts of the Gamaliel Foundation, an Alinsky-style, faith-based national network headquartered in Chicago. These are the same folks that trained our president, Barack Obama, in community organizing. We are now on our third or fourth incarnation as a group, and we've matured to a stage of development where we have a highly experienced community organizer, Mark Cass, at the helm as our executive director. We believe that systemic change for social justice doesn't just happen by begging or by being just nice or having the most rational plan. We believe that social injustice is the result of persons and groups who have the power to maintain the status quo that protects their self-interests and privileged statuses at the expense of others. We believe that a broad base of people can be organized and learn how to be leaders for progressive social change. We believe that conflict resulting from pressures for social change can be harnessed for outcomes reflecting the common good. Our task force model and coalition approach has served us well in the mobilization of our fellow citizens. Along with our public and private sector allies, some of our past and current accomplishments include addressing the issues of food deserts in Syracuse, that is, areas without easy access to full-service food stores, enrolling some 8,000 children who lacked health insurance, making significant incremental changes in how the criminal justice system works, expanding the number of full-day quality pre-K classrooms in Syracuse, and closing the gap of several hundred four-year-olds annually who do not benefit from this early start in formal education, and working on finding the best solutions when the existing I-81 viaduct comes down and is replaced, hopefully, by a street-level alternative. Every 3 or 4 years, we pause with our action agenda and do a listening campaign involving hundreds of people in our congregations. As a result of our listening campaign last year, we added community violence and youth to our agenda. And so last night, I was with two dozen people from throughout the community struggling with how to get a handle on those concerns.
let me be philosophical for a moment. The religious traditions that are represented in our interfaith network have always supported the work of charity, for example, food pantries. ACTS, however, represents congregations that understand the limits of charity and demand justice through systemic change. ACTS leaders are personally involved in multitudes of community ministries, but we understand that service alone does not improve inequities. Advocacy is our primary tool. It is the prophetic dimension of our traditions that compel us to speak out. That is what social action means for ACTS. So we seek to engage people from the grassroots of congregations in the community to use our power to bring about the changes that reflect the realization of a beloved community where justice, equality, and solidarity prevail. Thank you.
And thank you, panelists, and thank you for leaving us some time for questions. I'm sure that people are kind of synthesizing some of the things you said. I'd like to thank Ursula for pointing out that today is the 12th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. Somehow that got away from me. It'll be interesting to see how, maybe interesting to see how it is now handled in textbooks and how it will be handled in the future as a teaching kind of moment. But so thinking about something, what Ursula and everyone was really talking about active citizenry, and then something that Andy said about his son Eli struck me as that. I think we all feel this way a little bit. Yeah, I know about that. I don't want to talk about it. Just, you know, somebody fix that. So what are we doing? What should we be doing? What can we do to kind of instill or teach? Is there a way to teach social action? What are we missing? You know, what, talking about generations to come and the fact that a lot of what maybe passes for social action is opinion. We have a lot of opinionated people. We have a lot of people who are working towards individual rights. But what about the good of the community? Walt?
Well, I think the first thing that one should consider is to join one of the organizations. I think engaging in an organization that typically you don't engage in will also give you a perspective on what we all feel in terms of our missions. But more importantly is what Ursula was talking about is also understanding history, right? And then the last thing I would say is if you hear, for instance, Dunbar Center is struggling or any other organization is struggling, is that everyone in this room have some type of unique relationship or gift to say, how do I go down and understand the history of Dunbar Center? To understand it is a pivotal organization in our community. And what can we do, even if you don't know the folks, is just to lend a hand. And I think for me to come out of this room, I'm about action. I just do action. And so to me, it's not complicated. And so I would encourage you to do some research, look at organizations as Jubilee or whatever, but more importantly, these organizations up here, United as One, these are some great progressive coalitions, and we do focus on policy. We don't know each other. So I'm going to end it like that.
Anybody else?
I would just add, I think social action is 90% about showing up. Now, I didn't want to go out to that meeting last night. I was tired. My wife looked at me and she said, you're going out again, you know. But being present and listening and dialoguing with other people around the social concerns that we have is essential. And you can't do that if you're watching a sitcom or if you're even watching news and keeping yourself informed as best you can. So showing up, I think, is serving as a role model for others and the younger generations as well.
I just wanted to quickly comment on Sandra's, wherever she is, her question, in terms of what do you do or how do you do it? And I think part of the job that we have as organizers is to, within our organizations, to think about how to be welcoming and that when people do show up, that we make sure that their voices are heard within our organizations so that they're not just, you know, clocking in and clocking out, but feeling like they actually belong and own it. Yeah, so I think that, but that's, you know, we want you to show up, and then it's our, you know, it's when we're forming our organizations, really making them places where we're not just giving commands, but people have an opportunity to contribute their ideas.
I guess what I would add is that for me, and my guess is that my fellow panelists, this is true as well, that some of the most meaningful times in my life have been engaged in social struggle, working with other people about things that we deeply believe in to make a difference in our community, not focused on our individual families or our individual lives or jobs, but something broader, the ideals that we claim as a nation that we say we believe in, that we want to share with the rest of the world, which unfortunately we don't live up to very well.
So, great presentation. I really appreciate it. So we've talked a lot about the past and our traditional ways of organizing. Now we're in a new era with Facebook and social media, and I'd like you to comment on how your organizations are using the new social media and who you're getting involved that way, because I know increasingly, like my 27-year-old daughter, she reads everything online. So.
But well, Ursula, look at me because I'm the youngest. But first, I'll make an announcement here today. And Sharon, that's a great question. So I've been doing NAND for 10 years, activism over 35 years. I recognize that I'm an 8-track guy. So I say that proudly, you know. So what we have done is that I'm not running for the president of NAND in April. So I'm relinquishing my role, but I've identified a young, progressive young woman that has the tools that I never had at her age, where the Facebook, the Instagram, she does all that. And the goal for me, for her and Nan and the new membership that's going to be announced in April, is to really connect with the youth generation, the college campus, how I started off with, neighborhood folks, and to bring a new flavor to Nan, to grow it younger. So I will still be a part of Nan, but I recognize in order for Nan to sustain, to bring folks, we got to identify just exactly what you said. So thank you for that answer, that question.
I mean, at the Peace Council, we use social media, but I think, you know, with social media, we're not really we consume a lot of information through it, but a lot of it is we're also the product. You know, where it's really used for, a lot of it's used for advertising, and so I think that there are limits to social media. For the Peace Council, social media is the tool to get people in the room together for our members and supporters to share information. But ultimately, you know, my goal is always to, you know, get people physically to come out, to come together, to get in conversation. So I think that I think social media is great, but I think it's changing really quickly, and I think the goal should always be get people to show up.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Toby Shelley, and Walt, I'd hope to do a lot for you down at the jail in the Oversight Committee. I've taken a lot of calls in the Onondaga Nation as a retired police officer. I'm involved in ACTS. But my question is for Ursula. As you may or may not know, I'm a retired military veteran, 30 years, I'm an Iraqi war veteran. But I'd have to leave the base at the 174th a lot when your group was protesting. And it rubs a lot of us the wrong way. And I would actually argue for your group, saying you're fighting for a policy. You're not protesting the people. So my first question is that true? Are you're not protesting the people, you're protesting the policy?
Yes.
And secondly, if that is true, how can you change that perception?
Andy, you look like you want to answer, even though it's a question for me.
Yeah, well, no. Go for it, but I'm happy to jump in.
No, I think that's I think that might be a common misconception. I do come out to the base sometimes, but not as often as some of my comrades at the Peace Council. But I think the goal is to communicate that, you know, that there are people that are opposed to this policy, and I think it's a question of, you know, of tactics. When a group decides that, you know, we are going to pick this location because it has symbolic value, and we want people to know that, you know, that this location is connected to a policy that we disagree with. The Peace Council and Peace Council members also do engage in other ways of, you know, expressing our opposition to the U.S. The military's use of drones. And so, you know, we do also engage in lobby visits, letter writing, educational programs. So it's not the only activity that we do engage in. And I think that one of the things I think we could do better is engaging better with the community of veterans in Central New York, because I mean we have some members in Syracuse that are part of Veterans for Peace, but I think that that's maybe one of the things that we don't do as well as we could.
Yeah, I'd like to add someone who's been involved in activities connected to Seneca Army Depot years ago, Griffiths Air Force Base, that while our primary focus was challenging the policies that come out of Washington, there's also an effort to reach out to the individual people who carry out those actions. Many of you will recall that after World War II, there was something called the Nuremberg Trials, where individual German soldiers and Japanese leaders as well were sought to be held accountable for the war crimes that they committed. And the idea is that if a government is ordering you to do something that violates international law, that's a crime against humanity, that although you're down the line of command, you're not the one making the policy, that you still have some individual moral responsibility about what you do. And so there's some effort, and this is certainly part of what the Peace Council is doing, is to say to those individual pilots and other people there that we want you to think about what is this policy that you're involved in carrying out. And we know that that puts people in a difficult situation because, right, you took an oath that said, I'll follow my commanders, and that's a tough thing. But if we're going to talk about democracy, we need people to make decisions about what we're willing to do and what we're not willing to do. But thank you very much for asking that, about that and encouraging us to really be thoughtful about how we communicate.
Good morning. Really enjoyed your comments. I have a comment and then a question. And I say that. Ursula and Sandy mentioned one thing, and that was the about the protests that have been made about drones. Toby mentioned it also. At 5 o'clock this afternoon, I'm going to be down in Clinton Square. I'm going to be there celebrating the protest of 12 years ago when we said, don't go into Iraq. But what is the purpose of the organizers on that? But can I get my comment in first? And the comment is this. I'm a jail minister person. I go down there and I have met a prisoner. Interestingly, the guards are saying, this kid shouldn't be in prison. You know, he should not be in this jail. Another guard came up to me. He didn't come up to me. I found that he had arranged for the prisoner, the inmate, to be cleaned up, to help him, to show him how to clean up his cell. There are so many people, and we forget it, there are so many people in organizations that sometimes we pound because they aren't doing the right thing, but there are a lot of people in those organizations that are doing the right thing. And we have to just keep that in mind and not always be negative about organizations. Back to 5 o'clock this afternoon. What are you doing in Clinton Square?
We'll see you there. We're having a rally and a march to mark the 12th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and we'll have a few speakers from a student that will be reading a poem by an Iraqi. We'll have a veteran speaking about his concerns, and a couple of anti-war activists as well. And one of the things that we want to bring attention to is that Congress is considering another authorization for use of military force, which my understanding is largely symbolic because currently the U.S. is involved in the Middle East under the, I believe it's a 2003 authorization for use of military force. So my understanding is the current request before Congress is largely symbolic. We want to bring attention to the fact that we've been there for 12 years and things have only gotten worse. And people aren't talking about it. I think in the media there's not really good coverage of what the U.S. is doing in the Middle East. There's the story of Phil Donahue, who was fired for his coverage of the Iraq War. And recently, Brian Williams, made up some stories about what he did there. But ultimately, his supervisors praised him for his favorable coverage of the U.S. government. So, we'll be there to marking the 12-year anniversary, but also it's an opportunity to say that, not everyone in Central New York is, supportive of the U.S. military policy.
She won't let me hold it. One of the speakers said that social action starts with us, and I want to respond to the veteran's question over against the wall. I attended my family reunion in Atlantic City this summer, and we went to visit the aquarium. They have a huge aquarium there. And my 80-plus-year-old uncle, who is a veteran of World War II and Korea, wore his Air Force cap, and he sat, and I sat with him for a while, and someone walked over to him and said, "Thank you for your service." I have now taken it upon myself, whenever I see a veteran in the airport or we're in the line together, I turn to him or her and I say, "Thank you for your service." And that's the way I separate the policy from the person. And I would invite all of us to do that.
Okay. So I'm just curious what all of you and your organizations can do in the future to connect with the younger part of our population here in the county, because we have all these wonderful forums for us older people to learn and increase our knowledge, and we know a lot, but I think our high school students, for instance, who are in the midst of learning so much about history, could really benefit from learning more about your perspective on things. And I think knowledge, of course, is power, so the more they know, the more they can do. And so I just wondered how in the future you might be able to reach out to them.
Well, the ACTS organization has a youth initiative. We're now recruiting young people from throughout the community to give them leadership skills and so forth and have them understand what the potential of community organizing for social justice is all about. So it's part of our professional staff's responsibility is to enable the younger people, high school and college age folks, to join the struggle.
Yeah. Yep. I will also echo that when this is over, let's connect with our names. And I'm going to go back to when I started into the movement, Leon Modesty, at this time he was at Urban League, with Chucky Holstein, they put together what's called a Black Jewish Dialogue. We used to come and hang out. And they would bring whoever the young progressive folks at the time, we was radical, well, and to bring us together to have conversations. And that was always helpful so that it helped channel our energy. And so I really enjoyed those discussions in those days. So it sounds like, well, we talked here, but we don't have this institutional network or organization, how we feed into that is stable, is sustainable. But I would think this time we need to figure out how do we connect. So when I think of Derek Carr in those days with the university, we had great political relationship with university sororities and fraternities of color in particular. And so now that we're no longer engaged, we're older, we have stopped connecting, and so we got to figure out how to, as I'm transitioning out off the stage, how do we reconnect with that? And maybe at the Southwest Community Center, Sharon Owens, a progressive new leader, is that we sit down and bring those voices together, just begin to develop a strategy. So I think we first got to start with a strategy that's sustainable, so no longer we age out, it's still there. So I'd like to connect with you.
Go ahead.
I wanted to, first of all, just say I wanted to thank all of you for the hard work that you do. I'm aware of the activities that you take place in the community that you're part of, and I just know how hard you work. Thank you. My question is that I think a lot of people don't get involved in some of these issues like global warming, income inequality, how to fix the education system, because it seems so overwhelming. So how do your groups go about coming together and deciding on the practical steps that we have to take to move all of these issues forward? Thank you.
It's always on the fly, you know, you're in the bunker. Whatever the issue is that moment, you just gravitate. We don't have this deep resource. We ain't the Koch brothers where we have this sophisticated organization we can mobilize and all that. We just deal what we see in the moment, and that's how we always work. And I don't have any better answer than that. I mean, I wish I could be more thoughtful, but we, like I said, we're not the Koch brothers. I wish we had a Koch brother on our side, to be honest with you, for social justice.
Well, ACTS is much more systematic in the way it approaches things. I explained the community violence and youth meetings that have been going on. We have conversations with a variety of people to try to scope out the broad range of concerns, and then we narrow the field down to a manageable problem that we can really tackle. And the pre-K initiative that's resulted in the expansion of classrooms is a good example of that. We originally started out with a much broader concern that, you know, the city schools aren't able to get the job done, and particularly there are the 4-year-olds that need that extra help getting started with their formal education. So it happens. That group is still working to, because it isn't done yet, you know, and the political processes, the funding and so forth all needs to have continuing work toward convincing the policymakers that that's a priority.
Yeah. The work that Ursula and I have been involved with, the Peace Council, is in some ways appropriately in between these two poles. And the Peace Council, as Peter mentioned, has been a member group of ACTS for a long time. Mm-hmm. And one of our challenges in terms of that is that ACTS is very strategic, trying to identify a specific, winnable, achievable step that can be made. The Peace Council has tended to look big picture. How do we end war? How do we deal with economic injustice? And so the challenge is both wanting to hold on to those broad, long-term, inspirational visions and then break it down into small, achievable steps to get there. And we find ourselves often a combination of frustrated at the minor steps that ACTS is able to achieve, but also appreciating the thoughtfulness at that's part of what's needed. But we really need to balance both of those things, because without the longer-term inspiration, you know, one of the ACTS's goals was to get the county to issue IDs related to, and I'm forgetting the specifics of it, but that individual act, without understanding the broader context of the new Jim Crow, the tremendous marginalization of many, many people of color through the criminal justice system, that step seems completely inconsequential. In that broader context, it then is an important step forward.
So. Photo IDs you're talking about. Yeah. You're talking about the photo IDs that inmates come out. Linda Irvin was a part of working on that, so to get them back into the real world of having identification. So.
Can you stand? Would you stand? I know you can.
I just wanted to say we keep talking about the young people. Obviously, I'm not one of the young people. I live at the Nottingham, which is all old people. But we do all have not children, they're grown people and grandchildren. And I think if you'd speak more to us about some of these things and think, now I was called by the Peace Council to see if I would go on a march. No, I can't go on a march anymore, I'm too old. I get too cold, I can't go fast enough, et cetera, et cetera. But I could influence other people. Right. And I think that as we get older, we forget some of these pastimes because at the Nottingham, we're surrounded by somebody doing something for everything we need. And if you'd come to speak to us and stir us up a bit about
I got you.
Remember what.
I got you. Well, let me just say, Peter, when we had our own pre-meeting, and one of the discussions we talked about, because, you know, we was talking about bringing it raw and didn't want to offend, and one of the things Peter and I shared with Peter, we had this conversation, we said, this is an audience that we need to figure out how we connect because of the relationships, the value you have as an individual, that how we connect with that. So so I look forward to having that dialogue with you, and we had that conversation about how do we do it. So we're recognizing that we need to do more strategic networking with folks like yourself. All right.
I think a good example of something that's happened recently that that NAN and the Peace Council and ACTS have all been involved in is the protesting of proposed cuts to central services. We just think that's a great inequity that's looming on the horizon, that low-income people are going to be deprived of their mobility that is dependent upon public transportation. So at the public hearing, we were all there together. So that's a narrow focus, but it's within the context of a larger set of issues. I was there really representing ACTS and the Moving People Transportation Coalition, because we know when I-81 comes down, we're going to need more buses, right? And not only do we need to protest the proposed cuts today, but we need to have people working on the long-term financing so that public transportation is a sustainable service that our citizens will have available to it. It needs to be expanded, not retracted.
And obviously, public transportation is also a much more efficient way of moving people around than us all driving in our individual cars, so it also has important sustainability and climate change implications.
Shirley, I would love to come to the Nottingham.
Yeah.
And there's just one comment someone made recently at an anti-fracking event. We had a panel about the landscape of fracking and the growth of gas infrastructure, pipelines, compressors throughout New York State. And one panelist made a comment that, you know, it's really the gray-haired women of New York State that helped to stop fracking. And from coming to New York, and you know, and there's a woman that I know from Madison County, Miriam. She has a sign, "Grandmothers Against Fracking," and so I just think of you know, you say we talk to the youth, and you know, yes, I, you know, we're talking to my peers and younger people, older people, but I am very appreciative of, I would say, the gray-haired women in the Peace Council that maybe aren't, you know, are retired now, and that have, that are dedicating their time to social action. So you know, as much as yes, we have to reach out to the younger people, I'm really grateful for the people that give their time.
Yeah.
Bravo.
One last.
I'm appreciative of anyone with hair. It seems that, as you pointed out, for social action to be successful, it has to lead, or it should lead to political action. And yet the voter turnout in our community has been pathetic. I'm wondering what your organizations are doing to get out the votes.
Well, let me start. That's one of the Reverend L. Sharpton's issues that that he's mandating us to work on. So we just had a discussion with some of us to begin to talk about make our vote count. And when we see, and I'm going to give an example in Pioneer Homes, like 600 units, less than 20, 30 folks voted, and the question is why? And politicians today use consultants. They do the 51% rule. If only 100 people come out, let's get 51 of those votes. Versus how do we go make the case that you should vote, or the policies that, what is the policy that you think are important in your life that we need to be addressing? We no longer talk to the people. And so we have to continue to engage, that we have to challenge leadership to engage in neighborhoods. There's some elected official that doesn't get that for the body hall. No, they don't get that. But we, as those anti-not voting, as President Obama said, 66% of folks did not vote. You know, they're turned off on voting. They turn off on the divisiveness. We have to get through that. We need some shining light to say, don't get caught up in that. So we have a lot of work to do on that end. And it's not going to be done overnight. But in some areas around the country, young folks are engaging like we've never seen before. It's just in some pockets, you don't have the infrastructure to do that if you're just relying on both parties to organize. It's not going to happen with them.
You know, the Peace Council doesn't engage in electoral politics, so most elections we abstain from the elections. But you know, what Welch just said touched on this idea that, you know, a lot of people get accused of apathy, and I think it's more alienation right now, that you know, we don't really live in a democracy if 60% of people aren't voting, if you know, people's human rights aren't being met. We're not living in a democracy if corporations are controlling our elections. And so I think, you know, while the Peace Council isn't working on elections, we are working on finding ways to break through the apathy, get out information so that, you know, on election day, yeah, we're all voting, but then what are you doing the other 364 days of the year? How are you engaging in social action? Because if you're not engaged in social action and thinking about your community those other days of the year, it's, you know, it's more likely that you're not going to be showing up to the polls. Right. So I think it's a year-round work of finding ways, you know, and that's one of the things I've been thinking about recently, is that, you know, people of my generation getting accused of apathy. You know, we got the social media, the TV, but it's really alienation and feeling like your government doesn't actually work for you or represent you. So that's really our job.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sandra mentioned that I now work for Syracuse Cultural Workers, which is a national publisher of materials related to peace and social justice. And we have a number of products related to the 50th anniversary of Selma. And the main message of those is someone paid the price for your right to vote. And so we're really trying to link that historic struggle with the right to vote and with our responsibility to use that right. And also to point out that we're now in a time period 50 years after the Voting Rights Act was passed, when many, many states have passed laws which make it more difficult for more people to participate, which restrict people's right to vote. So we really need to deal with that issue, that we say we believe in democracy, but yet there's major elements of our community that would really rather not have poor people, people of color, other marginalized people's vote. They'd rather have them be part of that percentage that's staying home. And so we really need to challenge those public policy issues.
Thank you, Walt Dixie, Andy Major, Ursula Rosen, Peter Sarver.